join the Patreon to join the conversation. I have so many amazing guests on here that you're probably already following on Instagram or TikTok. So you might as well jump on here and talk to us, ask your very own questions, and you can get access to one-on-one coaching with me through the Patreon. Sign up. The link is in the show notes.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Parenting, Leadership, and Teaching Podcast. Today, I have with me Lauren Bond, and I'm not going to waste any time. Go ahead and tell the people about yourself, you know, what you do, what your background is. Let them get to know you, and then we're going to hop right into conversation because I'm excited for this one. We're talking about the brain. So go ahead, Lauren. Tell us.
Hi, everyone. My name's Lauren Bond. I'm a certified neurocoach and behavior specialist. I help people understand what behavior communicates, and it's all about bringing it back to the body, focusing more on who we are as mammalian creatures. And I developed a mindset model called the Red Brain, Blue Brain, and it's all about understanding primarily what we're communicating and ways that we can meet those needs effectively with the resources that we have.
So let's get right to it. Thanks for telling us who you are. What is the red brain, blue brain mindset? What's the difference? Tell us. We know nothing.
So basically, the red brain mindset is our kind of more primal mindset. So when we're feeling a bit depleted or in survival mode, which a lot of us are at the moment, we are in our more defensive mindset. So we are more focused on survival. So there's a lot more defensive based behaviors that can be more reactive. And we struggle to manage emotion, access logic and reasoning, and understand cause and effect. So that's kind of the red brain mindset in essence. I've developed it to kind of, in a way to understand, I speak about a resilience gauge. So if you look at it at the water levels here, the blue brain mindset is when we're all resilient enough, when we're fed and watered enough, when we have all of our emotional and physical needs met, we are able to access the blue brain mindset, and we're physically able to manage our emotions, access logic and reasoning, and understand cause and effect. But when our resources, our physical or our emotional resources are depleted, we can sink below the water level, and then we're in our red brain mindset. And often we can experience emotional overwhelm, and it can feel quite like we're drowning. We're all at various points of this resilience gauge, sometimes through the day, at the moment more often than not now. So the main aim of this model is to just eliminate any kind of perceived judgment, and look at the kind of facts, and all about looking at how we can evaluate which mindset we're in and adopt the best approach to help all involved.
So, you know, you talk about the red brain mindset. When we're in that mindset, it can feel like we're drowning. So does that mean that, you know, being in this red brain mindset is bad? I know we had a conversation about this, but I want to talk it out with the audience members.
Yeah, I mean, it's not bad at all. It's our survival instinct. And again, when we're drowning, when we're in that headspace, all we need to do is survive. So our main focal point when we're in that red brain mindset, our body needs to survive. So we're a little bit more dysregulated. Our body is primed to switch off all unnecessary systems in the body. So that's where kind of our ability to manage our emotion goes a little bit more offline, and our defensive primal behaviors are our first and foremost. There's nothing wrong with it. There's everything right with it. Our bodies are designed to survive. And I think the first port of call is to eliminate any kind of perceived shame around that, because it's exactly how our body is designed to work. And it's brilliant.
And so why do you've mentioned shame and judgment a couple of times, and I want to kind of tease this out a little bit. Why is it so important to eliminate the shame and the judgment? Talk about it, because there's a lot of it happening all the time. I think that we are in a culture of shame and judgment. It's kind of you know, what we do. So you're talking about like eliminating it, or at the very least, you know, decreasing it. Why is that so important to do?
Well, if you think so, I've referred to kind of perceived judgment as an anchor. So if we really focusing on that analogy, if you feel like you're drowning and somebody's judging you, it's an anchor around your ankle, really, and it just keeps you down. And there's nothing worse than if you're trying to swim and you're struggling for air and you're panicking, somebody's standing above you going, just swim. Why aren't you swimming? I don't understand why you're not swimming. It doesn't help you to swim. So it's just not a strategic use of resource. It doesn't help either party. And when there is shame or perceived judgment in the mix, there's automatically a me against you paradigm. And that's another anchor. So if somebody, again, feels like they're flailing and somebody is very much standing again above the water going, what's wrong with you? Just swim. That person is not going to feel any calmer to be able to access what they need to be able to swim and to be able to get their head above the water level. So yeah, it's just not helpful, shame or judgment.
So using the same analogy, right? The red brain is kind of like when we're drowning, when the red brain mindset is kind of when we're drowning, the shame, the judgment can really weigh us down and cause us to drown more, even though the person's intentions may be to help, try to help the person swim. What should they do to teach the person to swim or to help the person swim? What is the alternative?
Well, it's support, and I think it's less words and more action. So when you are in your red brain mindset, which we'll get into probably a little bit later, there's two main stress responses that I've likened to a ninja and a snowman. So there are people when they're in that red brain mindset that can exhibit as a ninja, so they're primed, ready to fight, and they're weaponized. And when a ninja is ready to fight, it doesn't respond to somebody telling it what to do or telling it to just put its weapons down. It responds to being shown that the environment is safe. So the only way that a ninja is going to put the weapons down is if it is shown through action that the environment is safe. So that's the best way to deactivate the ninja. And then the snowman stress response is people who exhibit more as a fawn or a freeze response. So when they're completely frozen in the presence of a perceived threat, what you need to help a snowman to thaw is warmth. So a snowman needs warmth to really help its access calm. So in terms of those models in and of themselves, actions speak louder than words. And in terms of how our bodies are made, we're mammalian creatures that thrive off social connectedness, and that's through gesture and tone and support. So what somebody needs when they're in a state of threat, if we were back in the day primal beings, if somebody was threatened, we would be helping each other through gesture, tone, and actions of support. And our bodies still work the same way. Times have changed, but our biological processes haven't. So those tactics still work. So, and back to the swimming or drowning analogy, what somebody needs when they're drowning is somebody to reach in and help them, or to go down with them and put their arm around them and swim with them to the surface. So to co-regulate with them, to help them and to show them how to swim, to get their heads above the water. And then once we're there, we can manage emotions and reframe and use appropriate strategies.
So it's almost like the warmth and creating the feeling of safety almost cuts those anchors that we were talking about before, so that the person is able to float. But, you know, that's not necessarily always enough. You know, you talked about going down under the water with them and helping them. What exactly does that mean? You know, that's co-regulation. What exactly does that look like? And, you know, could you share some examples of how we go underwater with our children and help them swim? Or we should survive in the moment, get them on the boat, get them on the lifesaver?
Well, again, I speak about inflatables, which those are. So it's unconditional positive regard, what somebody really needs when they're feeling overwhelmed is somebody to be in it with them. So particularly our children, if they're feeling overwhelmed, it's about really using our resources of body language and tone. And one of the most effective ways to help children access calm is this part of our face. So when we are looking and establishing, yeah. So literally,
the mask, no. Thank goodness the mask doesn't cover this part.
Yeah. Imagine. So it literally is establishing eye contact, letting them know that you're in it with them. And when I say eye contact, I'm not necessarily talking about this. The first port of call would be gauging where you are in your state of regulation and doing what you can, because there's no point if you're drowning, you can't help someone swim. So that's kind of the first port, which we'll get to in a bit. But it's mainly about helping them to co-regulate. So children, you can give a child an inflatable, but you still need to help them to swim with it. Mm. And children biologically are not able to self-regulate as readily as we are. They just physically aren't. So we need to model how to regulate. And an analogy that I use with some of my clients, it's almost like we're a battery and they need to charge onto us in order to get their full charge. And that's biologically what the situation is. So in terms of when a child is feeling really overwhelmed, it's about eliminating perceived judgment from the situation, because perceived judgment is me against you, so it's an anchor. It's being really mindful of anchors and inflatables. So focusing on the inflatables of, right, I'm in this with you, I'm calm, you know, as much as you can, being able to model calm as much as you can. But a posture, so this posture or this posture, you know, it could be seen as me against you. So it's very much looking at our posture. We need to be looking at what we are conveying and showing in our nonverbal supportive language. Yeah. And it's about letting them tune into us.
Yeah. You know, and I think part of that too is why. Actually, I just made a video about, or I just posted a video maybe a couple of days ago about, you know, authentic, like actually being calm, and that there's a difference between when we're trying to fake calm and when we're actually calm. And the same thing with anxiety, the same thing with frustration, with any emotions, when we are authentically, genuinely in that state of mind, in that state of being, in that state of emotion, we're more likely to have that kind of effect on our children. And, you know, part of it is, you know, likely because there are things that our bodies and our eyes and that are communicating to the child that we may not even be aware of. We're actually in that state of calm, and it could be, you know, I said some pretty like obvious things, but when I posted the video, so there were so many people who said like, this is so true. Like I learned, I've noticed this. Like when I actually, you know, when I really want my child to like go to sleep and I'm really anxious about it or trying to get them in for a nap, you know, it's those are the days where it tends to be a lot more of a struggle. But like when I want to take a nap and I actually am calm and say like, I might just want to take a nap too, then it's easy peasy lemon squeezy. And so like, you know, what you're saying is just connects and it makes a lot of sense and just aligns with, you know, a lot of the content that I'm putting out. So in terms of co-regulation though, I just said actually being calm is helpful, but what are some practical things that we can do, right? So what are some ways, let's say, because it's about navigating, being able to navigate away from the, you know, red brain mindset when it's no longer serving us, right? What are some good strategies to help children or help adults? Because we just talked about how important it is for adults to be able to do that too, to move from the red brain mindset to the blue brain mindset.
So again, I think the kind of first port of call is to be in it with them. And I think something I've been really conscious of, again, like we touched on earlier, there's no judgment in being in the red brain mindset. It's a state of being as a regulated or a dysregulated state. So sometimes if I have those moments, like, you know, when you're like, I will even say to my little boy, I'm feeling a little bit in my red brain as well. Like, what can we do together to get back in our blue brain mindset? And again, I think the more we're in it with them, the more we can both swim to the surface in that way as well. But mostly less words, more action. We're so conditioned to think that we'll say the right sentence at the right time when somebody's in that red brain mindset. And often that just does more harm than good. But just as much, yeah. And just as much as I say perceived judgment on the child's behavior, it's also perceived judgment on your parenting or practitioner behavior. I think, judgment needs to be removed across the board. So something that I've been working with a lot with my clients and myself in this lovely pandemic time is something that I've dubbed a conceptual reframe. So when something's happening that's really pushing your buttons or you're feeling really in your red brain, and our children, when they're reactive, they do push our buttons, and it is a threat. It's a perceived threat to our system, and we've got to acknowledge that. What really helps, instead of following that train of thought and trying to figure out what they mean by what they say and giving too much focus to that reactive behavior, it's about looking at what's in front of us, saying, right, he is hitting. I am feeling threatened. What are we going to do? So we're both in our red brain. That's our conceptual, what's happening right now. We're in our red brain, right? Breathing really helps. Do we need space? So often if somebody is feeling, and not everyone likes somebody to be right in their space when they're in that red brain mindset. And if a parent is dysregulated, they cannot help a child regulate. So if the parent, if you are feeling really in your red brain and you're going to blow, again, a good modeling script is I'm feeling a little bit in my red brain. I need to just go and take a few deep breaths. I'll be back in this amount of time. And let's take some breaths together. So modeling what we need to do to access calm. So it's often breathing, less words, and just sitting in it. I think so often we're conditioned to get rid of it now. And once cortisol, if stress is in our body, it can turn to cortisol, which is a minimum of 90 minutes before it completely leaves the body. So it's literally about figuring out, right, how can we sit in this together, and how can this not be something that we need to get rid of? How can this be something that we swim through together? And I think so often that trying to get rid of it makes it so much bigger than it needs to be.
Yeah, I so agree. And I think about sometimes I actually enjoy being a little sad, a little dysregulated, a little frustrated. And I think about, regulation and balance kind of the same thing. And I think of it as not a constant state. Like, we don't need to always be completely in balance, right? Mm-hmm. And I think someone who's in completely in balance is someone who's not moving, right? I think that, balance, regulation, it's like a teeter-totter almost. Yeah. I know this is probably like the episode we've done the most analogies. I love it. I'm here for it. So it's like regulation is like, it's like a teeter-totter. Sometimes, you're a little further, one way. And so, you adjust. Mm-hmm. You're kind of constantly adjusting. And you may not, and there might be some moments where you feel like perfectly regulated. Those are just as important as the teeter-totter moments, right? Absolutely. You don't get there without a little bit of the teeter-tottering.
Absolutely.
And it's the red brain that lets us know that, like, ooh, we're a little far over on one side, over on the other side. And it's that inner distress call, maybe like for help. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about a situation that I was in. It was during that time. I was in a classroom, and with my job, I'm not always in the same classroom all the time. So a lot of times I'm still kind of figuring out the children and really kind of all their, different quirks. But I was in this 3-year-old room all day. And so nap time came along, and this child had already been, he was already kind of like dysregulated, and he had said some things that just like, and I don't know the family. But he said some things that I knew he was having a hard time. I also knew that like he was coming very consistently, and because of like having a quarantine, he had to stay home, and so he was going. So there's a lot of things going on here, and so during the nap time happened, and everyone else was pretty good, like laying down, but he was still feeling really dysregulated, and I knew this prior to lunch, and I was hoping that the food would be enough for him to kind of get the equal state nap and then wake up and be great, but it didn't work out that way, and he started to. He started to like try to like tear things down, right? Because he was really upset, and it was like this, it was something that someone else had said something. I think he was trying to play with another child. They didn't want to play that way, and so he felt, you know, rejected. He felt upset, and the way he responded, he started to tear down this bulletin board paper, and that was the way that he was, you know, expressing himself. And in my mind, you know, you talk about judgment and shame.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking like, oh man, like this is, I'm in this other teacher's classroom, and now the child is tearing down like the bulletin board paper that like she put up, and like, man, she's going to be like probably pretty upset, and like that, like I would like allow this to happen. So there was a little bit of like judgment coming for me, and like, and maybe it's a little bit of like my ego, and like, I'm Mr. Chaz, like, you know, like the kids like, I can figure it out, like, you know, so there's a little bit of that, like, kind of just, like, just self-talk, and that is putting me in my red brain a little bit. And so I kind of approached it by, you know, I started to talk to him, quickly realized that it was not helping, and, you know, trying to, like, redirect him, like, was not helping, and I was trying to get 9 other children to sleep at the same time. And so what I did is I kind of like what you talked about. I created that feeling of safety with like with my body. I was close, but I wasn't too close. Anytime I get too close, I knew exactly where the barrier was. I created the feeling of safety while helping other children go to sleep, because like I have to multitask because the world couldn't stop. Like. Everything else of like, you know, cleaning up lunch, helping the other children, you know, lay down, getting, you know, making sure that they're using the bathroom so they don't, you know, have an accident, and, you know, all the other things I'm doing, still kind of trying to do in small ways, maybe not with the same pace, but I'm still trying to keep a little bit of momentum. And so I kind of just stood next to him while I was helping someone else, and I kind of saw his body start to relax. When I saw his body start to relax, I didn't say any words. I just opened my arms.
Perfect.
And then he came to me. And I'm like, okay, we're here. And then I made a mistake. And I was like, okay, let's get on our cot. And then that frustrated him even more, because that was what I was trying to get him to do before. That cortisol was still in his, his body. Still had this kind of, you know, the fight response. And so like he kind of responded, but he pulled away a little bit, and he took off his shoes, and he like threw his shoes, like, I don't want to be on my cot. I'm like, okay, I understand. You don't want to be on your cot. And validating, hearing him out, you know, and then their words kind of stopped there. Like, I get it. Like, you don't want to be on your cot. That's cool. You can be here right here with me. So I'm getting everyone down, like, you know, patting them and just kind of cleaning. He was holding my hand. And then when I could settle down, because I was still moving, trying to get other things done. And so he was still kind of moving, but he was holding my hand, so we created a connection. But then I just put my hand on his back, and I just sat there. And like, I was just like tapping into my calm. Like, Mr. Chaz, like, you just have to be like, you know why this is happening. Now it's time for you to like actually get into that calm. And like the bulletin board paper, that's fine. Like, it could all be fixed. Like, the shoes off. And I'm thinking, oh no, like, it's a licensing violation if like he has his shoes off. But like that's not the biggest deal. Like, it's fine. And so like I'm sitting there, and I decided that like I'm no longer under pressure. I'm just gonna be a state of calm, and I'm gonna allow him to catch it. And so he kind of sunk back into my arms, or to my one arm, because my other arm was like patting a child, because that's what a child needed. And then at some point, he said, "Mr. Chaz, can I have my shoes and put my shoes on?" And I said, Yeah, you can. Let's go get it together. So we put his shoes on together. Again, in this moment, like I can feel like us bonding.
Yeah.
Put shoes on together. I don't say anything. I don't tell him to get on his cot. I say, would you like for me to pat your back? And again, just creating the safety, the connection. And then he said, no, can you rub my back? Oh, and I'm like, sure. So I tucked it in, I rubbed his back, and within like 30 seconds, he was out, he was asleep. But that was just a story. I just wanted to kind of share a story of what happened, you know, with me. And even, you know, I talk about like, I'm always giving out like the tips, like don't think like there are always times where I have to talk to myself and remind myself of, you know, what to do, how to be different, you know, what that child needs in that moment. As a teacher, I also have, you know, I'm also thinking about what the other children in the room need and then what the actual room needs and license situations and all that other stuff. But I just wanted to share that. Do you have any thoughts on that before I go to the first question?
Yeah, I mean, I just love it. And I think, again, like, it's about really eliminating judgment again from like kind of getting it wrong, because we're doing what we're doing. And it's just about, again, focusing on the physiological facts of, you know, dysregulation, red brain mindset, or regulation, blue brain mindset. And a child is not going to sleep when they're dysregulated, when they're full of stress. And so exactly what you did. And I think a lot of the time we're conditioned to think there's a quick fix and there's a quick, there's a quick way of getting there, which ends up piling pressure onto us, and often puts us more in our red brain, and then we end up being more reactive than we need to be, which makes it a bigger beast. But I think, again, it's just looking at the aim in any given moment. If there's reactive behavior, there's red brain mindset activity. What do we need from that situation? We need a child to access calm if they want to sleep. So what are we going to do to get him into that blue brain mindset? The only way he can get there is if he can hook onto your battery. So exactly what you did, spot on. And again, like, you did it. You showed him. You went down while he was flapping and drowning with his inflatable, helped him to swim to the surface. When his head was above the water, he then could, and there's evidence of him being able to manage his emotion, access logic and reasoning, and ask for what he needs and be able to sleep. So,
exactly, you know, what happened. And every time things like that happen, I always like reflect and just think about like how, you know, beautiful the whole process is. Like, I really look at it more of an art than a science. Like, it's more of a dance. Then, you know, putting parts together to make a whole. And that's where, like, a lot of, you know, there are a lot of other people who, like, make content and a lot of behaviorists. And I don't know if, like, I'm probably going to get a lot of people are probably going to just, like, unfollow me, because I know that some people listen to my content. But I have to say, candidly and honestly, that it does make me uncomfortable when we talk about these processes, you know, or like these, you know, of going in and helping save a child from, you know, drowning and, you know, dysregulation as just kind of like a set of processes to do, or like a procedure. And it makes me, because it for me, it takes like that human connection element out of it. And I think that while you may get, you know, a result in terms of like a behavior outcome that you're looking for, I think it does a disservice to the process, the relationship, the connection, and a lot of times the true long-term goals
that we have. Well, that's one of the biggest problems with the fawn response. It's not recognized as a stress response, and often a procedural, you know, behavioral modification model, like you say, that that can, you can see progress, you can see it quickly, but it won't be sustainable, because if it's going often, it can be a fawn response. So it's a snowman response. And it's misinterpreted as compliance, but actually what it is there's a, it's a stress response. So that child is internalizing, I cannot express myself and I need to, you know, minimize my needs in order to be accepted. And the main aim for any child is to be part of a pack. We're mammalian creatures who need to be part of a pack. So any threat of isolation, the child will adapt their behaviors in order to remain part of the pack. But like you said, it doesn't necessarily mean that that is innate, you know, sustainable progress.
Yeah. Thank you for your thoughts on that. I appreciate it. Let me get to hop to a question. My 5-year-old was recently diagnosed with anxiety. We're pretty sure he has sensory processing disorder as well. We are also curious about ADHD, but as of now, there isn't a diagnosis. As a family, we are learning and working hard to help him find ways to regulate when he has big feelings so that he doesn't become physically aggressive. The last few months have been hard, but I feel like we've been learning and practicing are finally starting to stick. When he's out of the home and away from us, though, he has a harder time self-regulating without our reminders and guidance. It is mostly an issue at school, where he would frequently scream at and hit peers when he encounters big feelings. Mm-hmm. I think this is exacerbated by being outside for multiple hours at a time, and I think he encounters some form of sensory overload with everything that he feels, sees, and hears outside, which triggers some of his anxiety. Any advice on how to help him work through with his teacher and to help him with his self-regulation at school? And part two of the question is, how do we explain to parents, older relatives, that neurological differences that lead to behavioral issues are not character flaws or naughtiness, and physical punishment won't fix any of the issues?
That's a great question. I think, again, when you're working with a school, it's really important to achieve a consistency of approach. So if things are working at home, it's really important to have those conversations with the school in terms of what's working, what's not working. But I think what will frame that conversation in the most effective way is collaboratively deciding on goals. So from what it sounds like, the goal is to improve conduct behavior and to obviously help him to self-regulate. He's 5, he's really little, so he's not able to self-regulate independently yet. So it's going to be quite important for the school staff to really have that discussion with the parents to explore what's working and what's helping him to co-regulate. So in terms of improving his conduct behavior, so if we want to minimize those reactive behaviors, we really want to encourage more blue brain activity. So it is about having that conversation about inflatables. So on my Instagram page, it's unique_behavior, I've got a little diagram there about blue brain and red brain approaches, and there's a list of blue brain approaches that are really nice key factors to frame an intervention approach around in terms of unconditional positive regard, somebody feeling seen, heard, and understood. So kind of really key factors in looking at ways to really cultivate that blue brain activity. Because what I'm hearing from the question is the goal is really to help him to manage his emotions and to access logic and reasoning. And to do that, he needs to be in a calmer, more blue brain mindset. And he needs the adults to adopt an approach to help him to co-regulate in the most consistent way as a team.
Yeah.
And in terms of his, you know, neurological differences, I think, again, that standing point that we're all unique, not one of us is you know, completely, you know, together, or no one can stand up and say that they don't have any little quirks. But again, it's I always just come back to strategic use of resource. if he feels judged, it's more likely that he's going to slip into his red brain mindset and we're going to see more reactive behavior. So if we really want to help him to thrive, so the model I work off is a reset model, which is resilience enhancing strategies to thrive. And that's all about how can we really help children with inflatables. So we want him to thrive. We want him to be able to manage his emotions. And part of that is having a healthy sense of self and feeling completely held in a spirit of unconditional positive regard. And so whatever he's expressing with his behavior, whatever he's trying to communicate, if somebody is shown to support him and fully accept him and that there's no perceived judgment in the scenario, we're going to get the best out of him. And I know families would want that. They would want him to thrive.
Yeah. And, you know, in terms of tools, I mean, I'm going to answer the two parts as well. In terms of tools, I would also direct you to my, you know, Instagram and TikTok and soon, you know, to be YouTube channel where, you know, I sing, you know, the turtle song. That is something that is completely school like friendly. It's great in a school environment. Everyone can kind of be a part of learning how to regulate when you are in that red brain mindset and how to calm yourself down. It talks about, you know, taking a deep breath and breathing. It's kind of like, you know, Daniel Tiger-ish. It's not Daniel Tiger, but it is a song that the teacher can use to help, you know, your child, you know, learn to self-regulate, because it's one of those inflatables that Lauren is talking about. Now, I would also add to this conversation that, like, when you're having this conversation with the teacher, that also being aware that as a teacher, having this conversation may put her in a red brain or him in a red brain mindset, because a lot of times teachers can feel like, you know, there's a problem here. Either the problem is your child or the problem is me. And really it's neither are necessarily the problem, but it's just about figuring out the problem is how, you know, how can we work together to solve the challenges that, you know, the child is drowning? What inflatables can we throw out there? How can we teach a child to swim? The child is not the problem. The teacher is not the problem. The problem's the problem. Let's work together. Teacher and child face toward the problem. And so just be really mindful of that, because I know, you know, conversations, you know, and I hear the conversations after the conversations of like, this parent, like, you wouldn't believe it, you know, like, she wants me to do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, a lot of times it can feel like you're being attacked from a, you know, from a teacher perspective, just like, you know, from a parent perspective, you may be feeling maybe a little attacked when they call and they say, hey, you know, so-and-so hit a teacher, like we're having some issues. So just being aware of not only the red brain, blue brain for children, but for us as adults.
Absolutely, and
really actively trying to create that safety and warmth that you talked about, to cut the anchors so that we can float and face the problem together.
Yeah. Let me just quickly add a little onto that. So what really helps with when I have conversations with practitioners, because again, I totally concur with what you're saying, and I think teachers now more so than ever need more praise than anything else with all they've had to do through the pandemic. But I do a little analogy called car crash scenario with them. So I say to them, right, let's get in this child's headspace. And again, it's their headspace. And it's about really getting them to see, right, what's helpful and what's not helpful. And not in a critical way. But if you say, right, it's a little bit of a dark analogy. But if you've been in a car crash and if you're you know, coming out the rubble and you're sitting on the side of the road, if somebody had to walk right up to you like this, how would you perceive that? Would you perceive that as threatening or as supportive? And my intentions would be helpful always, But when somebody's in that cortisol mindset, when somebody's in that red brain mindset, it's body language and you know, gesture that they're evaluating. So in terms of, right, if my pitch really went like, are you okay? I'm saying a really supportive phrase, but your body is perceiving it as a threat because your body is just, you know, on edge and in that red brain, ready to strike mindset. So it's about, right, what would help if you were sitting on the side of the road, if I approached you slightly from the side, so I'm less confront from the front, more kind of I'm accepting, but I'm still giving you your room. And I say, right, are you okay? I'll be back in 5 minutes, like pointing to a clock or being very specific, with a cup of tea or with a glass of water. Stay there. You know, so it's supportive. It's my calmer tone. It's my gesture that you would be more inclined to access calm through that approach than that approach. And both are equally well-meaning, but it's just about understanding the physiology of that mindset.
You know who I think would be really good to like talk to about, you know, how they do it is 911 callers, because that's the number one, you know, they're constantly talking to people who are in panic. And that's like the main thing, like they have to stay calm. And that's like, even through the phone, through their tone of voice, that's what they're trying, you know, to do, emit calm so that, you know, that you can calm down and actually think a little bit more logically, be a little bit more in your blue brain, even though you're in like a red brain scenario. They're trying to tap into that blue brain a little bit so that you can give them the information that they need so that they can, you know, send the lifeboat out to you. And so, yeah, I think that like if anyone out there is a 911 caller, I might even like, maybe I'll have you on the podcast one day. We'll just talk about that. Now for the part two of the question, she asked like, how do you explain, you know, parents, older relatives, neurological difference that lead to behavioral issues that are not, you know, without, you know, they're not character flaws or naughtiness, and physical punishment won't fix the issue. My favorite like analogy that this is the podcast of analogies. My favorite is just talking, like, I really do believe that, like, you know, whether, you know, neurodiverse or not, like, everyone has their own superpowers. And and it's usually the things, you can usually see them really definitively in young children when they are, you know, doing things that challenge us. It's usually their internal superpower that they have not learned how to hone yet or to use yet in an appropriate way. And it's the, you know, and I think about even, you know, people who are deaf, that creates more space for them to really be able to see things. And they're able to like catch sign language quicker than what other people do and learn new sign language quicker than what someone who has hearing and sight could do. Someone who doesn't have any, you know, someone who doesn't have any hearing, their sense of touch might be even more attuned. And so like, even the things that we look at as, you know, it's our weaknesses make room for our strengths. And sometimes because our strengths are taking up so much room that, you know, there's, because our strengths are taking up so much room, like that is all we see. But as they grow, as people grow, as, you know, children grow, as they develop, as we help them, as, you know, they find mentors, they learn, you know, to regulate so they can kind of tap into their blue brain, we are able to hone into our superpowers, you know, our strength more. How many people out there listening, you know, had something that was difficult for, you know, the adults to deal with when they were young, that it's now something that helps them in, you know, their real life or their, you know, work life. You know, I can, even starting this podcast was an impulsive decision, which definitely made for a lot of, like, you know, inconveniences for the adults who were in charge of me when I was younger. But it's something that has helped a lot of people. And the same thing with, like, me being, like, extra energetic and me asking a bunch of questions. And, you know, I literally just had this thought right now. One of the main things that, like, probably biggest complaints that I got when kind of growing up from, like, my teachers is that, like, I would ask too many questions. I was always asking questions, and maybe part of it was, like, I wasn't always attentive. So sometimes I would ask, granted, sometimes I'd ask a question that may have already been, you know, answered. But I was always super curious. And now, like, as I'm having this conversation, now it's, you know, I'm asking people questions. I'm bringing people on the podcast. I'm asking questions. And that's, as I got older, as I got into college, that wasn't so much of an issue anymore. That became strength. You know, it created conversation. It, you know, it helped me learn more deeply about the topic and helped me actually be interested in the topic. And so the way that I would, you know, frame it and for, you know, child and others, that these things, the defiance, the impulsivity, the you know, whatever it is, or even maybe they don't speak out a lot and they don't do a lot of talk, like, oh, they're an extrovert, and we'll, like, you know, we'll, like, shame extroverts for not being as talkative or whatever, but they tend to be more observant and may notice more than what someone like me, who's being an extrovert in the situation, I don't notice because I'm too busy talking and having to, you know, I'm too busy, you know, being in it to take a step back and observe. And so an extrovert like me may really need an introvert on their team to balance me out. And we see each other, and that introvert may really need me to, you know, push the idea that they had because they were observant, right? And so that's kind of the way that, like, I think about it. Like,
it's so true. I said that to my little boy the other day. He was really upset because he's 7 now, and they're at the age now, you know, they're all trying to be cool. And he's very imaginative. He loves these, like, alternative worlds, and he loves imaginative play. And his friends are saying, no, imagination's stupid. And the other day he just burst into tears and he said, I feel really lonely, Mommy. No one understands me. And it was exactly what you said. I said, we all perceive life in different ways. And you might be lonely now, but you haven't found your tribe yet. And it's about, you know, again, like you say, when you went to college, it's about finding that time to shine, like you say, show your superpowers.
Yeah. 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 That is so true. And thank you for sharing. And it also actually, that made me think of, I'm just, like, sharing my childhood now. Like, people want to know about, like, if you listen to my podcast, you, like, I kind of slowly divulge more and more about, like, my childhood and, like, about me. But, like, one thing that I also remember too, that, like, I remember playing with toys a lot, I think, older than what was cool. Like,
yeah.
Like, I would play, like, with action figures, and I would have this whole back and forth battle between, like, in the whole, like, story plot, everything, and be, like, in my room for hours, kind of just, like, playing. And I remember feeling, like, a little bit of shame and hiding it a little bit because, like, I thought, I don't know, is what someone, like, said, but I kind of felt like I was too old to do it. But I had this internal drive to just, like, do this imaginative play. I think the way it shows in my adult life is that, like I'm a creative person. Like, now, you know, making the TikToks and the, you know, the Instagram, and, like, today I did a whole story thing. And even outside of, like, right now, just, you know, writing poetry and, you know, and things like that, that, like, I've always had this internal need to, my brother would say, like, this internal need, as my brother would say, to get these bars out, but really to express creativity. And, you know, Brené Brown talks about it too, that like we all need to be creative in some way.
Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to do one more question just because there are a lot of questions asked this week. And for anyone out there listening and I didn't ask your, and answer, do your question, I will pick up from the questions next week. Okay.
Brilliant.
My question is regarding my 6-year-old daughter, Charlie. Her father and I split when she was 6 months old. We've always been on the opposite ends of the parenting style spectrum, with her father being extremely authoritative, which has recently been validated with emotional abuse and neglect last fall. In parentheses, it says, our state attempts to rehabilitate the family rather than remove custody. But there's been layers of support in both homes and home-based therapy. Charlie has a lot of anger which manifested in internalizing and externalizing her emotions. And her emotions, including slamming doors so hard that she breaks the frame. Defiance on my parenting time, as well as hitting, kicking, and punching me. During her tantrums, she calls me the worst mother ever. And she wishes that she were never born, which I know and understand are just her expressing the emotion. We have made progress on some emotional regulation through awareness of emotions and feelings, as well as sensory tint and an icebreaker activity to help uncover her trauma. Any thoughts on how to help her voice and navigate her through this difficult time?
So I think, again, it's just going back to that, you know, red brain drowning analogy. And she's clearly exhibiting as a ninja. So she's feeling quite overwhelmed with her emotions. And she's very much, if she's had an experience of a lot of perceived threat, particularly from a parent, she's super, you know, like you'd speak about superpowers. She's a very skilled ninja at defending herself. And she's got a lot in the toolbox of smashing up things and annihilating things around her when she feels in a state of threat. So it's about, again, looking at, right, a ninja, it's looking at this is how she's expressing. And I think the mom is so beautifully, you know, said, you know, we're helping her express her emotions and really work through this trauma, which again, you know, shows that's such a beautiful starting point. In terms of what she's communicating with her behavior, she's trying to express that it's an energy that needs to get out. So in terms of kind of hitting and kicking, a helpful tool to use with that, when the child is coming at you, trying to hit or kick you, it's about really being very boundaried and saying, right, I can see you need to get that out right now. It's not okay to hit me. It's not okay to hurt me, but you can punch that pillow or, you know, and redirect saying, right, I can see that energy coming. You need to get it out. Let's punch that pillow. And it would look like putting that strategy in before she's actually coming at you. If you can see, you know, her starting to escalate, really trying to get it there and saying, right, we need to get this energy out. How are we going to do it together? And punching a pillow together, or modeling how to get it out in a safe way. And then that way, eliminating shame, because particularly with these behaviors and particularly if they're trauma-based, shame is one of the biggest anchors that we're dealing with. So as much as we're looking at her behaviors, this is what you need to do to get this out. I'm going to help you navigate this to do it in a way that you're not hurting anyone, because I know that's going to make you feel even worse. So how are we going to get this energy out in a way that everyone can stay safe? You know, and in that way, that kind of co-regulating, holding space for her, you know, while she's doing it as much as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when a child is used to, when it's been her environment, especially, you know, it sounds like throughout her life, you know, from the time she was very young, she gets very used to being in that red brain, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that is almost like maybe where she feels like her balance should be, or, you know, she's so and I talked about the teeter-totter, she's used to it weighing down more on one side. And so that is just, you know, that's just where she's always kind of going to sway. That's where she's going to sway more quickly. And I think, giving her tools to sway to the other side. And, you know, she may need more tools and to talk about how to, you know, get into the blue brain mindset and, you know, to, you know, grab onto those inflatables than what, you know, other children may need. And so I would, you know, I would definitely suggest things like, you know, having like a calming space and a place where she can regulate and, you know, stress balls and, you know, things that she can manipulate with her five senses and smell. And I would also recommend, I would recommend teaching her the turtle song, because that can be something that is, can then become a part of her, especially if it's like a song that she really enjoys. And so now it's, this is, she can kind of make this a part of her story. Go ahead.
Singing really regulates blue brain activity as well, music and singing. So yeah, that's a great strategy. And just providing, like you say, providing more safety cues, and the inflatables in that scenario are less words, more actions. And I think in terms of mum and her energy resource, it's really exhausting if somebody's coming at you to think that there is an ideal script or there is something that you can say to, and actually fundamentally there's nothing that can be said when somebody's in that ninja mindset. It's about how can you show her that it's safe, and that's less words, that's that car crash scenario, you know, just I'm here when you're ready, and exactly what you did with that little boy, just trying to access that calm herself, and then being able to hold space for her, and then exactly what happened with that little boy, she'll be able to access it when once she's supported to the surface and can manage her emotions more readily.
Yeah, and you know, one of the big themes that you've talked about and you've mentioned kind of over and over is creating the feeling of safety and creating that warmth, also just to bring it, just connect it from adult to child. These things are also true in a workplace environment. When, you know, the more successful businesses, the teams that are more productive, more successful, the companies that are able to, you know, retain their employees, are the ones who actively create a feeling of safety. And there are a lot of, you know, in a workplace environment that can create feelings of uncertainty and not safe and judgment. And part of it is, you know, we bring those things to the environment, right? We also create systems that bring those things to the environment. And so just even think about yourself when you go to the workplace and, you know, how the difference, and, you know, if you've had multiple jobs, like think about the difference you feel going into a job where you feel safe, connected, warm when you walk into those, through those doors, and think about that feeling as opposed to maybe a workplace where, you know, there's a toxic work environment where you don't feel safe, or you do feel like someone's going to be judging you, and, you know, you almost can't, it's hard to focus on any of your work and just spending more time, maybe even creating more, you're catching those kind of toxic habits, and also likely you're going to be more likely to create more toxic habits, like, you know, the gossiping or the sabotaging, or like, well, I'm not going to do that. Like, they're not, you know, less of a, we're in this together. It's us towards the problem. And, you know, working with children, same thing. Working, if you're a leader, a part of leading a team, a company, any group of people, that feeling of safety is so important. And I would highly encourage anyone out there who is in charge of people, who's leading people, to think about how they are creating that feeling of safety, not just through the systems, but also through those things of the nonverbal.
That's exactly it, yeah. day. Absolutely. And because we're mammalian creatures that are designed in social connectedness, and we thrive through social connectedness, and that's how we co-regulate. And that's why we're struggling so much in this pandemic, because we're not able to co-regulate as much. We're in isolation. And when you are in isolation, your body dysregulates, because those mammalian instincts of being separate from the pack dysregulate us, and we go straight into survival mode, you know. So, and again, in those toxic work relationships, it's a me against you. So that's red brain mindset. And in a spirit of social connectedness, where everyone is part of the greater whole, it's us against the problem, like you say, which is oxytocin. And when we're focusing on goals in a spirit of social connectedness, that's flooding oxytocin into our body, which is enabling our body to thrive in every way. So in terms of productivity, again, as a business, if you want to see your productivity levels rise, it's about really doing everything you can to cultivate that blue brain mindset and that social connectedness to get the best out of everyone, because cortisol and isolation disables people. Like you say, in a toxic work environment, you can't think because you're in survival mode. So you're less able to manage your emotions, access logic and reasoning, and executive functioning. So it's just not a strategic use of resource.
I love this conversation, Lauren. I'm so sad that we have to end. I feel like I'm going to have you on another time. Love talking about the brain. I love the red brain, blue brain mindset. Thank you so much for helping to answer these questions. And just for this, this part might not make the like podcast, but just so right, Monisha, right before she hopped off, she made a comment. I just would like for us to address it. She might look at it in the Facebook later. So I just would like to talk about it.
Cool.
Or mention it. She said, I feel like allowing my child to hit a pillow or stomp away in anger or any other physical expression of anger is triggering and hard for me, because although they are not hurting anyone, I was not allowed to respond in that way when I was a child. So I'm in my red brain and not sure how to respond either.
And again, it's no one size fits all for anyone. And I think that's such an incredibly reflective thing to say. And, you know, that's a really beautiful acknowledgement. And it is about it's finding what works for you. So it's not one size fits all, because we all perceive life in our own unique way. And again, we all have our triggers. So there's no point telling somebody to do something that's going to trigger them, because then again, you know, the parent's going to be dysregulated, and that the objective is not, the goal is not going to be achieved. So the principle, it's about really looking at the principle behind it, in terms of kind of figuring out what is your authentic style of execution. So if that is not authentic to you, it's about looking at how can she get that out in a way that is less harmful. So if a child is prone to hitting or kicking or blah blah blah, it could also be, like you say, a sensory regulation toolkit could really help to kind of harness that energy before it gets to the point where she's kicking or hitting. So maybe a better fit would be looking at kind of some sensory processing activities. So joint compressions really help. And often a child, if they're wanting to connect or they wanted to touch or tumble, it could be a proprioceptive input that they're craving. So in terms of kind of meeting the need before it's expressed in a more reactive way, could do joint compressions. A nice one is tying a rope on a door, and she can, pull the door. Or again, just getting it out in the form of a dance party, you know, jumping on pillows. We do sushi yoga. So we do yoga, and then I wrap my children in the yoga mat, and they spin. And it's a really good proprioceptive input as well. So they're feeling those needs, you know, feeling met. And so, yeah, I would look into kind of sensory processing exercises if that's a better fit. But at the end of the day, don't do anything that's not authentic to your parenting style. But the thought behind that whole suggestion I made earlier is about eliminating perceived judgment and shame from the situation and saying, right, that's an energy that needs to get out. How could we do it in a way that keeps everybody safe?
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Join the Patreon to join the conversation. I have so many amazing guests on here that you're probably already following on Instagram or TikTok. So you might as well jump on here and talk to us, ask your very own questions, and you can get access to one-on-one coaching with me through the Patreon. Sign up. The link is in the show notes right now.